Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, joined by the one and only Chad Bird, or as people know him by his Twitter handle, Chadalicious, or Birdalicious, or whatever that looks like.
Yeah, Bird Chadalicious. Yeah, that if I had a dollar for every time someone had looked at my email and told me, hey, you know, when I first looked at that, I thought it said Bird Chadalicious. I'd have a pretty good pile of cash. I don't know why I chose that, because my name is Chad Lewis Bird, but I never, in my choosing of that, never dreamed that it would be interpreted that way.
It does kind of look like Bird Chadalicious. Yeah.
Somebody told me one time they thought that was my wrestling name. I'm not sure where they got that, but it is really Bird Chad Lewis, even if it looks different.
I'll try to refrain from every single week by introducing myself and then saying joined by Bird Chadalicious.
Yeah. If I had a dollar for every time that mistake has been made, and for the a dollar for every time people have told me that in my 20s and 30s I look like Bob Saget, I'd be pretty much mad. I just posted a picture on Facebook of when I went to Siberia years ago in 1999, actually. I taught at a Lutheran seminary in Novosibirsk, Siberia. Anyway, I got a picture of there me on Red Square, and I could have predicted it. There's somebody commenting saying, hey, you look like Bob Saget. Yeah, I know. Been told that many times. Not anymore. That's why I grew a beard, so I didn't have the Bob Saget look-alike going on anymore.
Yeah, that wasn't that. You're saying that Bob Saget's not one of the guys you're like, awesome, sweet, I'm gonna go with that.
Yeah, not exactly my hero. Not what I'm out to emulate.
If somebody's like, dude, you look like Brad Pitt, you're like, I'm gonna stay with this look as long as I can.
Yeah. I'm going for Wolverine, but I'm just, no one's ever made that comparison yet. that's my goal.
Yeah. People usually end up saying I look like some cartoon character or something. It's never some like awesome actor. They're like, dude, you look like, and it'll be some Muppet character or something. You're like, yeah. What?
You're like, oh, thanks. Appreciate that. Yeah.
You look like Big Bird, dude. Oh, great.
Oh, man. Where are we at?
Oh, I think we threw a tree into some water, made it sweet, and
waters this time. Yeah, that's right. That puts us at the chapter all about manna.
Oh, that doesn't have anything to do with Jesus.
No, nothing whatsoever. It's that there's no connection whatsoever between the bread in the wilderness and the bread of life. But maybe we can make something up as we go along.
Yeah, let me see. I'll try to connect some dots as best I can.
Yeah, see if you can make a jump here to a certain chapter in the Gospel of St. John somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you're a listener, a faithful listener, you know that we crossed the Red Sea. We sang a song. We came to Marah, which means bitter. The waters are bitter. So God showed Moses a tree, which he threw into the waters, sweetened the waters. And then they moved on. They camped at a place called Elim, where there's a whole bunch of water. There's 12 springs of water. There's 70 date palms there. So kind of a nice little Garden of Eden in the midst of this wilderness. And they stayed there at least for a while, but then they had to leave. And that's where we are at the beginning of Exodus chapter 16. They set out from Elim. And all the congregation of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Well, it's not really the wilderness of Sin. If you read in your English Bibles, you'll see that it's written S-I-N, but don't get confused between the English spelling there and our word for sin.
Dude, I've totally been there.
Yeah.
If anyone wants to know, that is in Arkansas. I'm dead certain of it. I'm pretty sure that I have. I could freaking map that thing out. Like, I've been there. I've spent a lot of time in the wilderness of sin.
Yeah. You know, it does work very well, actually. You know, it is kind of a wilderness of iniquity, of sin, but it's kind of a double entendre, I guess you could say. It's in Hebrew, it's the wilderness of seen, written like S-E-E-N. I have seen this wilderness. But in English, in our translations, it usually comes out as capital S-I-I-N. So, I mean, it's a great little handle there for preaching, I suppose. We're going to talk about the wilderness of sin.
Isn't it? Everyone's convinced that's right next, that that's wherever they live. You're like, wilderness of sin. Like, yeah. I'm pretty sure that's my backyard.
It's got to be. That's right. I've spent many years in the wilderness of sin as well. I know the terrain like the back of my hand.
You went camping there?
I built a house.
Yeah.
I sank deep roots in the wilderness of sin, in fact. And it's between Elim and Sinai. So that kind of situates us as to where we came from and where we're going. So they leave their camp at the springs of water, but they're not all the way to Sinai yet. We're still working our way there. And it's already we're already halfway through the second month. So some time has passed, about a month and a half since everybody left Egypt. So they're a little ways into their journey. And, just like we heard before, back in chapter 15, verse 24, when the people were thirsty, they grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" So here again, in verse 2 of chapter 16, we encounter grumbling once more. And this kind of, broadens the whole spectrum of who was doing the grumbling here. In chapter 15, it says, "So the people grumbled at Moses." But here it says, "And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel," and here's what they said. Here's the content of their grumbling. "We wish that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat." James is flesh pots there. "Sat by the pots of meat. And when we ate bread to the full, because you," speaking there to Moses and Aaron, "you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly."
By the way, that's the name of my next band.
Flesh Pots?
Flesh Pots, yeah. If I ever start a heavy metal band again, Flesh Pots is on the list.
Flesh Pots. Yeah, that image is always kind of grossed me out. I don't know why, but Flesh Pots, this is... conjures up this image in my mind of death for some reason. But pots of meat sounds a little better.
Pots of meat. That's it.
Do we put meat in pots?
Yeah, dude, that's
barbecue
that's,
grills.
That's
when we sat by the barbecue grills.
Oh,
that
dude.
Would...
I got a pot, like the pot roast, bro.
Oh, there you go. Okay, pot roast. We sat by the... when we had pot roast, we had plenty of bread. In the land of Egypt,
pot roast and bread, or where it's at on a Sunday afternoon. We make a pretty big habit of this. Like early in the morning, the pot roast goes in. I go do all my stuff I gotta do at church. Probably end up going out to lunch with some people. Get back in the afternoon, take a nap, get up. The whole house smells like pot roast. Dinner is served. It's a great thing.
Damn, you've got it all planned out. It's nice.
I'm not prepared.
It's a very good very good tradition. Very biblical.
It is. That's why we do it.
So this whole verse is kind of a nostalgia in some ways, don't you think? I mean, they're thinking back. So think of it this way. So they're in a situation now where they're looking at the present through the eyes of the past. So they're looking at their current situation. They're hungry. They're in the wilderness. They're free, but they're hungry. You know, they're no longer bound to follow the dictates of the Pharaoh. They're stuck out in the middle of the desert, and they don't have any food there. They were lacking water earlier. They become nostalgic. They think about the good old days. And it's interesting how when this happens, when nostalgia takes place, that very often we tend to exaggerate the deficiencies of the present and to exaggerate the happiness of the past. So when we engage in nostalgia, it's like we look back, and I hear this all the time when people talk about the good old days. You know, why can't we bring back the good old days? Well, the good old days had plenty of good old sufferings in them as well. There were a lot of deprivations in the good old days, whatever those good old days might have been. So we tend to forget about the sufferings and the lack and the pain and the heartache that we suffered in the past, and tend to just focus upon those good things whenever we're engaging in nostalgia. And that's what's happening to the Israelites here. So earlier when they're in Egypt, they're crying out to the Lord because of their oppression. But now when they're free and in the wilderness, they're looking back on those times as if they were the best times of their life. And so I think when we engage in that kind of nostalgia, very often what happens is we our ingratitude for the present gifts of God decreases. We have this kind of unrealistic memory of the past. And what happens in the present is we're ungrateful for what we do have. And as we see here with the Israelites, this crisis of the present, in this case, the crisis of hunger, leads to a crisis of faith. And we begin to doubt that God will provide. We begin to doubt that God is on our side. We begin to doubt his love and his mercy. And in some cases, people even doubt his power or his existence, depending on how severe the crisis might be. That's what's happening to the Israelites. The same thing that happens to us in our own wilderness of sin, if you will, that whenever there is some kind of deprivation that we're undergoing, maybe it's, you know, it's a sickness, maybe it's a period of grief, maybe it's a financial crisis, maybe it's a marital crisis, whatever that that cross we are bearing in the present might be, that leads then to a spiritual crisis as well. The physical side of our life and the spiritual side of our life are inextricably intermingled with one another. So then what happens to us physically almost always inevitably affects us spiritually. Don't you think?
This is most certainly true.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, because in those times when there is a crisis, that is typically when God is most at work in our lives. At the same time, though, when there's a crisis, that's when we tend to have the greatest struggles and the greatest doubts and begin to question all sorts of things that we never stop to question when we're happy and got plenty of money in our bank account, we're healthy and all those sorts of things. So it's, you know, it's like the times when God is most at work in our lives are the times that we would never choose on our own, because they're never easy times. They're always hard times.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times it's in that God is also working. This is why God is nuts a little bit. But and I'm just gonna own this and play on those words. But maybe it's not accidental. I don't know. But it is. It is, and as much as the shoe fits, like, God is at work in the wilderness of sin, it seems like, quite often. I mean, those are the times when you probably are in a bad place of your own doing. I mean, there's a couple of different kinds of ways that we suffer. I mean, they all have to do with sin, because sin is the reason we're in a fallen world. But there's some things that you certainly didn't, you can't control. I mean, it's not your fault if you're born blind, or mm-hmm. or you have some kind of, you know, if you get cancer or something like that, this is probably not your doing. But I don't know about you, Chad. Most of my suffering is like pretty self-inflicted.
Yeah, like 99.9% of my suffering is due to my own stupid choices.
Yeah, and yeah. Like, and this doesn't mean like, hey, go out there and make sure you suffer something. But like, that's when it is in those times that where. Sometimes in that suffering, you get to the point where, like, I mean, you can't do anything about it. It's your own fault. And God is the one who like has to come, and that's where he's rescuing you and lifting you up and teaching you, and that happens a lot of times in the midst of being in what feels like very much a wilderness. A wilderness that you yourself like weren't just placed into, but wandered off into. Mm-hmm. And it's not fun. That's one of the reasons I don't recommend it. It's not a pleasant place to be. But you do find out that, sure enough, like, God is there too.
He likes to work in those places where you look all around you and it doesn't seem like there is life. It doesn't seem like there's hope. It doesn't seem like there's a way out. Well, that's God's workshop. That's where he does his best work, is because when there's really nothing that we can do ourselves to get ourselves out of the situation, when there's really, at least to our vision, no possibility of hope or restoration. Well, that's when God steps in and he does the kind of work that he always does. He brings life right into the middle of death, and where there's darkness, he brings light. That's the way he's always worked. He brought all creation into being out of nothing, and so he continues to work that same way.
Yeah, and totally because you deserve it.
Yeah, because we're such good, upright, holy, righteous people. That's the reason God acts that way.
You see this clearly with the people of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, they're in the midst of their praising God and living righteous and holy lives. God provides the manna for them.
Totally relying on him. No doubt, no anxiety, no like accusing God or his servant of abandoning them or leading them out to die. None of that. Just pure unadulterated faith, bro. And then that's when God's like, you know what, manna for you.
It's amazing in this chapter that God doesn't get angry with the Israelites, isn't it? Moses does a little bit later on. But God, that is one of the striking absences of this chapter, is the anger of God. They're complaining about what God has done. They're complaining to Moses and accusing Moses of trying to kill them. In a little bit, they're going to break the Sabbath rules. But throughout this, God is nothing but gracious and giving and forgiving. He really is. This whole chapter is a great example of his long suffering in the midst of his people's hard-heartedness and grumbling and complaining about their situation.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, when you see God providing bread from heaven, right, to a bunch of people who don't deserve it, who are not trusting or loving him the way they ought, considering that they were just like pulled out of Egypt. That's strikingly similar to the way that the bread of life, the true bread from heaven, comes and what he comes into. Mm-hmm. I mean, he comes into a very similar situation where the people are a little grumbly, a little complainy. Spiritually they're a mess. You know, there's a reason that John the Baptist came first. It wasn't because like everyone was super prepared to receive the Messiah. You know,
right?
God didn't look down and be like, you know what, this is prepped nice. Like, let's go. I mean,
yeah. In fact, I was looking at this morning. I was curious, and this is the. This wouldn't be of interest to everyone, but I'll put it out there because I think it is a little bit of an insight into what you were just describing, Dan. So the Greek translation of the Hebrew here for grumbling in verse 2 of Exodus 16, that Greek verb for grumbling that's used there is the exact same verb that we find two times in Luke's gospel when it describes the grumbling of the scribes and the Pharisees against Jesus. And what I find especially interesting is that both times it occurs, it's in Luke 15 and Luke 19, both times that verb occurs, it is in the context of Jesus eating with sinners, which I think is pretty insightful here. So the kind of mess that we have here with Moses and the Israelites in the wilderness is the same kind of mess that Jesus is going to encounter when he comes into the wilderness of Israel in his incarnation. And the same grumbling that was taking place back then is the same kind of grumbling that we're going to hear in his own ministry, where people are turned against him. Ironically, because of who he eats with. So it's a whole, just like there's grumbling here because of food, there's grumbling later on in Luke's gospel because of food as well, that the Son of God would deign to eat with those that the Pharisees considered religious lowlifes.
Yeah, that hasn't gone anywhere. That what's crazy about that is like, and I'm about to bunny trail here. Sorry, we're talking about food now. We started talking about food once we started on pot roast.
It's all over.
It's all derailed. Yeah. But you have here people are grumbling and there's food involved, and then you have the Pharisees like they're hacked off at Jesus because there's food involved. And you know what's crazy is like you think that this gets fixed. Like at the cross, and like this would just be done with. Like people won't do this anymore. But then you like go into Acts, and you see Peter, like compromise with some Judaizers. Like I'm not gonna eat with these Gentiles because I don't want to hack off these dudes. And you're like, bro, did you not hang out with Jesus for 3 years? Was this not like the exact thing that he did that like got people annoyed and actually, like to the point that after it says that they saw him eating and drinking with tax collectors and prostitutes, that it says like after that they sought a way to kill him. I mean, so you know this, and yet like the propensity that you still have is to be like, oh man, there's some holy people. I better not be seen with those people.
Yeah,
I don't want to eat with them. I better not eat with them. If you think that it has somehow like that ended with Peter, you are also sadly mistaken. Like the equivalent of that most certainly still goes on today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah, by all means. The more people are worried about obtaining and keeping the approval of the religious elite, whoever those might be, then the more they're going to worry about being associated with those that the religious elite object to, right? There was a tweet that was going around for quite a while. I can't remember who tweeted it originally, but it says something like, "If you want to ruin your reputation with the religious, then hang out with those that the religious reject," or something along those lines. And that's very true. You don't want to be associated with certain people because if you do, then you're going to become those that the religious superiors are going to reject. Well, that goes all the way back to Jesus. There's few things that are more Christ-like than befriending those that the religious establishment keeps at arm's length or rejects entirely.
Dude, there are few things. Yeah, there are few things more Christ-like than wasting your righteousness on sinners. Luther like says that part of the Christian life is the calling to do exactly that. Mm-hmm. That and obviously we don't have any vertical righteousness to waste. We're all in the same boat when that comes to that. But what he does mean by wasting your righteousness on the sinner is that the perceived righteousness that we have, that horizontal righteousness, that good reputation, that upstandingness before the eyes of other people, that we are to waste that on sinners. He calls that rolling around in the mire with them. It's like real graphic, man. But that's what it is. I mean, Jesus didn't seem real concerned about whether or not his reputation was gonna get like all messed up based on like who he was willing to love and show compassion to, and that's where he's not concerned about that at all. You know, some people say like, you know, you've heard like, you know, man of no reputation. I'm sometimes like, it's not entirely true. Like he just had like a really, like by the end, it's just like a really bad reputation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I think the mistake that a lot of people make with regard to this whole reputation business is they mistake their reputation for their ego. And these are two different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesus wasn't worried about his reputation in the sense of his ego. But that's usually what happens is people are, you know, they want to hang with the right people because they want to look good. In other words, they want to have, you know, their ego is desiring. They want to feel good about themselves. They want to look good in the eyes of others. And so they want to make sure and keep the people that can give that to them on their right side. And so they know if they hang out with the sinners, with the infamous, with those that are rejected by the religious elite, they're going to lose some of that approval. And so their ego is going to suffer. And they might use the whole reputations as an excuse for avoiding those people, but it's only their ego they're protecting. It's not their reputation.
Yep. Yeah. Jesus, not a man of much ego.
No.
Not counting equality with God something to be grasped, even though he was God. Now that's being humble right there, bro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he emptied himself out, being found in the likeness of man and hanging out with those that were considered really to be subhuman by the scribes and the Pharisees.
Yeah,
that bunny trail took us quite a ways.
It did. We have detoured way off the path. That's what the wilderness of sin will get you.
That's what happens.
We're wandering around for 40 minutes in the wilderness here.
Well, we'll get back to manna. So we're going to circle back here, backtrack from Galatians through the Gospels back here to Exodus 16. Back to the grumbling of the Israelites and the flesh pots that they're missing from back in their Egypt days. So how does God respond to all of this? Well, he several different ways, but as far as the physical part of it, he gives them two gifts. It's mainly on the manna in this chapter, but actually there's two different food gifts that God gives them. One is the manna, which becomes the daily gift that he provides and continuing all throughout the 40 years in the wilderness. And the other is the quail. So in this particular area of the world, quail were migratory birds. And so they would, of course, fly south for the winter months. They fly north for the summer months. And this would have been kind of in the springtime toward the beginning of the summer when all this happened. So there's some sort of migration that's taking place, and God takes advantage of that in order to bring quail into their camp. So he provides for them quail at evening time. I'm in verse 13. It came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp. So now they're going to have meat to eat. And they received quail more than once. There's a pretty famous story in the book of Numbers that's parallel to this one in many ways, and quail is given to them there as well. But that's an occasional gift. The meat is, but what becomes their daily ration is manna. So what is manna? Well, that's kind of what the Israelites wondered. Most everyone's probably heard this, but just to explain a little bit the name manna. This is from verse 15 of chapter 16. It says, the Israelites get up in the morning, and there was a layer of dew around the camp. Nothing unusual about that. But as the dew evaporates, they see this fine flake-like thing on the ground. And so they're looking around at this stuff, and they don't know what it is. And so they ask a very simple question. In Hebrew, they said, manhu, which means, what is it? And that became the name of the stuff. So manna really is, what is it? That's the literal translation of it, which is kind of a funny name for bread when you think about it. You know, don't we have a candy bar called Whatchamacallit?
Whatchamacallit, yeah, it's manna.
That's kind of the equivalent here. Whatchamacallit, give me one of those Whatchamacallit. So they're eating, what is it? For 40 years in the wilderness, so, manhu, or as it's usually pronounced, manna.
So this is so you're saying this is like a flaky thing on the ground, and I have to just believe that this is just communion wafers with the morning dew.
The communion wafers that have been stamped with a picture of a cross on.
Yeah. Totally. That's why, much like when I go up to communion and they have the wafer, I also say, what is this?
Yeah. I thought we were getting bread. What is this?
What is this?
You know, there's a whole lot of ways that the Old Testament describes manna, and so it's kind of hard for me anyway to get a clear picture in my mind is actually what it looked like. Okay, so it's called a flake-like thing in verse 14, but later in the chapter, in verse 31, it says the house of Israel named it manna. And here it says it was like coriander seed. Well, coriander seeds are a little bit bigger than a pea, and they're white. So it's got two different descriptions here. In other words, it's called a flake-like thing earlier in the chapter, and then here it's called something that kind of resembles a coriander seed, and white in appearance. And then we have, so I don't know exactly what it looked like. We have two different descriptions there, but we're told more than once that it tasted like wafers with honey. And that's pretty consistent throughout the Old Testament. The description of its taste is wafers like honey. So what is it? Well, this is my opinion on the manna. There is, and this is widely documented, and you can read about this in the various commentaries. There is widely documented in this part of the world a secretion that's put out by insects. These insects are like little aphids, and they feed on the tamarisk trees, which are very popular in this part of the world. And they secrete this sugary substance, which forms into seed-like secretions, hardens. And it's actually still eaten in that part of the world. In fact, the Arabs call it manna. Now, it could be that what we see here is related to that. I tend to think that it is. Now, did I just deny that it's a miracle? No, nothing whatsoever. Instead, I think this is an example of God taking something that does occur in nature and amplifying it, and miraculously amplifying it so that there was enough there for the people to consume on a daily basis for 40 years, no matter where they were. And he so worked it to where there was enough for them on Friday to cover not only Friday, but the following day, which was the Sabbath as well.
Hey, slow your heretical roll, Chad, because what I hear you saying is that sometimes God might take food that already exists and multiply it, which seems wildly unbiblical.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that this morning as I was deliberating whether I was going to go full bore heretical on you or not.
I mean, if only there were other instances where, like, God incarnate took things that we already eat and then, like, and took like a small amount of them and then made enough to feed like a great multitude. If only that was somehow, if that was precedented, I'd be okay with it, but. You know, that seems very outside the nature of God, and probably
yes,
is heresy.
It does. I think this does actually fit very well with dovetails very well with the feeding miracles of the 4,000 and the 5,000.
Yeah.
You have in both cases. What do you have? You have people in the wilderness. You've mm-hmm. got Moses as the leader. You've got Christ as their leader or their teacher. You've got hunger in both cases. And then you've got some things from nature. Okay, in the Old Testament, you have the quail. I mean, nobody tries to say these were like miraculous birds that just God made appear.
Angel quail.
Yeah, angel quail that just popped out of heaven and fell there in their camp. And so these are natural quail, and I suspect that the manna was this natural secretion, sugary secretion that's found in this part of the world. And God simply used that, multiplied it, magnified it in order to provide for all of these people. And then you go to John 6, for instance, where the feeding of 5,000 recorded in all four Gospels. So you can look in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. And you got the same situation. You've got a lot of people in the wilderness around a teacher. They're hungry. And so what does he do? Well, he takes some fish and he takes some loaves of bread and he multiplies it. He miraculously amplifies that to provide for their sustenance. And, of course, in John 6, where this happens, that's where you have the whole discussion about Christ being the true bread that comes down from heaven.
Yeah, you know what's cool is in the feeding of the 4,000, there's this little line. I actually think that it's the reason that feeding of the 4,000 is even included in the scriptures. It's like just for this. Because it comes after the feeding of the 5,000. And you have like John saying that, like, you know, if I wrote all the things that Jesus did, like all the world could not contain the books, that sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Yet for some reason, they decide that the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000 are going to both appear. Like you're going to have both those things, which seems redundant. One, because it's like the same deal. Like, we get it. Like, you can take some fish and some bread and like multiply it. Like, but you're giving it to us twice. Not only that, but you give it after the 5,000, you give us a 4,000, which is like kind of a lesser miracle. It's not like
6,000, right?
Yeah, if it was like reversed, I would get it. Like, yeah, and then you thought that was impressive, but how about this? But no, it's like less. I think the reason it's in there is because of the words Jesus says, and it says that they were out in a desolate place.
Mm.
And then it says that he was moved with compassion.
Mm.
So there's he's moved on with compassion on the crowd. He asked for if there was any food. He's moved with compassion to feed them lest they perish.
Mm.
And that's the language used, which is not used in the other ones, but I think is you can probably move over to the other ones as well. But I think this is what you see then, that in desolate places where you will surely perish, God is moved with compassion and cares for you. And it becomes really clear in that text. And I don't think that's dissimilar to what you have going on with the children of Israel in the wilderness, is that not because they deserved it, not because they earned it. Not, I mean, they're grumbling and all this stuff anyway. But God is moved with compassion, and without him acting, they will surely perish. Which also ties into like the whole reason behind the incarnation. Like why do we end up with the bread from heaven? Because God so loved the world, for God was so moved with compassion for the world that he gave his only son, or sent bread from heaven, that we might not what? Perish, but have eternal life. I mean, I think all this works together.
Yeah, yeah. It all ties together. And then it all then is contemporized for us. I mean, these are great stories, what happened in the wilderness then and what happened with Jesus feeding at the 5 and the 4,000. But the beautiful thing is that then God continues to do the same thing for us. We, in the midst of our whatever wilderness that we're in, whatever we're going through, God is right there having compassion on us as well and feeding us. He has compassion on us in the midst of our physical and our spiritual hunger. And he continues to give us the bread of life. He continues to feed us the manna that comes down from heaven, which is Christ himself. I mean, every Sunday, he draws us to himself in the Lord's Supper, and he feeds us the true manna, his own body, this bread that gives life, this bread that bestows life upon us, in order that we might not perish, but have that everlasting life that is found in Christ himself. He feeds us that life as he feeds us himself in the supper.
Yeah, everything is amped up in Christ, where you have in the Old Testament in the manna, or the bread from heaven, the miraculous bread, as it were, right? But he says this, it was miraculous, and it was the provision of God, but all those dudes still died. Unlike the bread that he says that represents, that points to, which is the true bread from heaven, which is his flesh. And you eat of that, and you will live forever. That's the promise. That's the John 6 promise. The John 6 promise is, eat my flesh and drink my blood, and I will raise you up on the last day. And in the Greek, man, it's one of my favorite texts in the Greek, that's so emphatic that he will, like, I mean, it literally just says, like, I will do it and not another kind of thing. Like, I mean, like, he's so emphatic that, like, the flesh that you eat is the one who's going to raise you up. Nobody else is going to raise you up on the last day, which is why I am the greater, like, I'm not just the greater David and the greater Joseph. I'm the greater manna. Because all those two people died, but you eat this, you're never going to die.
He who lives and believes in me shall never die.
That's it. And that's it.
Amen.
And that's it. We're out of time. You know, I think we're going to probably have a little bit more to talk about on the on the provision front next week.
Yeah, we are. In fact, a lot of this chapter actually talks about the Sabbath as well. So we'll come back and talk about that some more before we move on.
All right. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining us. If you're interested in hanging out with us sometime or going to some of the Christ Hill Fast events, go over to ChristHillFast.org, go to the event page. We're going to be in Detroit here. Man, by the time this airs, real shortly, we're going to be in Detroit May 6th. And then me and Chad are both going to be in San Diego in October. And that's something you do not want to miss. Go over to HereWeStillStand.org and check out all the good things that are going on there. And we really would love to see you there. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.